In today's episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be discussing some rules for looking at technology platforms, stacks, frameworks, and APIs. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 105. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it.
I'm Rob. I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. Well, I am glad that I have CrashPlan installed on my laptop. As of, about an hour ago, I jumped online to look at the podcast outline you'd created, and my laptop won't boot up. It just locks up at the Windows start screen. So I'm messing around with it. I'm sure I'll be able to fix it this evening. But if not, I'm not stressed about it. Like, I'm more worried that I'm going to waste 3 or 4 hours screwing around, either reformatting the hard drive or whatever. But it really is so different than 5 or 10 years ago, where like all your data was on this local disk and you didn't have it anywhere else. Or you had like a 2-month-old backup somewhere. But between Dropbox and CrashPlan, which runs every night and upload my personal stuff and business stuff up to a cloud somewhere, it feels much better.
Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of in the same boat. I have probably like several different ways of like backing up all my stuff. So I have Dropbox running for a bunch of data, and I have a SugarSync subscription, which backs up another set of data. And then I have Backblaze, which takes an entire machine backup. And then I also have Acronis running, which takes a full system snapshot like every night as well.
That's the way to go. You know, as long as it doesn't impact your performance, the computer performance day to day, it really is nice to have some options. What I wish though, you know, so I now have a spare router at all times on deck, because I've now had 2 brownouts or thunderstorms in the past 6 years that have blown routers. But I'm considering like getting an on-deck laptop, because I'm losing a bunch of time this afternoon. I guess I have this desktop sitting here, but as soon as my wife gets home, she's going to need it. But what do you think about that? Do you have a spare router, and do you have a spare laptop?
But I have extra switches laying around for exactly that purpose. Like, what I do is I have everything going into my cable modem, and then from there it goes into my network, and I have first thing that it hits is actually one of my servers. So I can plug it into either directly into a switch or into my server. Like, my server I have behind, it basically acts as another wall between, you know, my network and the outside world. But I also use it for like VPN and everything else. So
right, got it. Yeah, this router or all the Netgear routers that I use have firewalls built. They have a hardware firewall built in, or maybe it's software, I don't know, but it's built in. So I have that as well. I don't have the VPN capability, although there are certainly routers you can buy with that.
Right. But I mean, I do have extra switches, and I don't know if I have an extra wireless router around. But I know what you're saying. And then in terms of extra spare laptops and stuff, I have a couple of spare laptops laying around. I think I have two spare laptops on top of my regular one. And then plus I have a desktop. And as you know, I mean, I have a whole army of machines here. I could hire like 30 people and every single person would have their own machine.
Not need to scale up. Yeah. And I mean, it seems wasteful to have just a laptop sitting around on deck at all times, but I really want to get to the point where when this happens, because this happens like once a year, you know, and I basically lose a day of productivity when I don't have that day to give up. And so I'm trying to figure out a way where I can be completely virtual. I would just love to be able to step to the left and log into this other laptop or this desktop and just not even notice the difference. And that day is not here, even with Dropbox and CrashPlan. I'll get my data back, but it's going to take a bunch of time for me to, you know, sort this out.
Yeah, I think your best bet would be to do something similar to what I do, where I've got my entire machine being backed up to, I have it actually backed up to a local drive, but I also have an external NAS device that I could back up the entire system to. And it would just store differentials every day or every couple of days or whatever. And if I need to go back to another instance of the machine from several days ago or a couple of weeks ago, I can probably do that. And with something like Acronis, you can, depending on how you want to do it, you can back up to the exact same hardware, which means you either pop out the hard drive and put a new one in and you restore back to that machine. Or if you have another physical piece of hardware that you would prefer to restore to, you can do that as well, even if it's slightly different. All you need to do is you need to switch out the hardware abstraction layer. And most of these software packages that do that kind of backup have the capability to do that for you.
Nice. When someone starts that as a service, call me. So I was in Pasadena this weekend with the family. We went down and saw the Space Shuttle Endeavor. They retired the space shuttle and they flew it all across the country. And so, and then they took 72 hours. They drove it like 4 or 5 miles an hour all down through LA from LAX to this, basically it's a science center, and which is awesome. If you're ever in LA, you should take your kids there. Cause I lived in Pasadena for 5 years and never went. And this thing is, it's a free science center and it's one of the best I've ever been to. And I've been to at least half a dozen across the country and in Canada as well. So it was a lot of fun. I also got to hang out with Jason Roberts and his wife and kids.
Oh, cool.
And it's a lot of fun hanging out and talking tech, man. You know, there's just so few people that I run into day to day that I'm able to sit down and just engage in, like, pretty quickly get deep into, like, conversation about serious things, you know, like what we do for a living, and have someone understand when you talk about a really detailed concept about marketing or about a new idea, and to actually get realistic feedback. And it was a lot of fun.
Cool.
He's the kind of person where I leave the conversation, no matter how long we've been talking, I leave feeling like we're in the middle of a conversation. You know what I'm saying? Like I have so much more to say, but it's like, well, we just had a 2.5 hour lunch. We have to leave. You know, I got to go pick my kids up. It was really cool.
That's awesome. So I came across a couple of different technology blogs today offering advice for choosing technology. And both of them misspelled one of the technologies that they were recommending. It was just really bizarre to me that they were able to make recommendations about things that they... I'm not sure whether it was just a misspelling or what, but it seems hard to believe that somebody could make a recommendation about something like a specific distribution of Linux and then misspell that distribution of Linux.
Yeah, it's hard not to discredit when people do that. Just like when I'm hiring people, like I would send people emails or send them a message on Odesk when I'm thinking about hiring them. And if they reply back with like all lowercase text with no punctuation and they're using the letter U instead of Y-O-U, that is a huge, huge red flag for me. And I know the person can be, you know, super intelligent. That might just be a style thing, but I instantly basically discredit them. Like it's a major red flag for me. And I feel like same thing with this technology. If you misspell it, you're right. You could just be bad at spelling. It could just be a typo, but that does not bode well for my confidence in your recommendation.
Right. And it's to be clear, this was an actual blog post. It wasn't like it was a transcript. Like I would understand if things come up in our transcript, and I've seen them come up before where it's just clearly misspelled. And it, because it's a transcript, you know, and we are using a transcription agency, I don't expect them to know the spelling of all these different things. And that's, you know, that's one thing. But this was an actual blog post that was somebody was trying to convince you, oh, well, these are the things you should look at, and this is why you should use this particular thing.
So I have an answer to one of our most frequently asked questions. And that question that we both get on the podcast, and I also get when I do public speaking, and just, you know, I feel like it kind of floats around a lot, is how do I get traffic to my landing page if I put up a landing page? And Dan Norris from Informly, which is inform.ly, he wrote a 3-part case study of 13 pre-launch traffic strategies that he's used to market his startup Informly that hasn't launched yet. And so it's a 3-part post, and it's really in-depth. He gives like actual conversion rates, how many visitors he got, and it's really cool. It's on my blog, softwarebyrob.com. The 3rd part just went live today. And so that is actually the new place. Whenever anyone, because I get this question, whether it's through the podcast or I get it multiple times per month, and that's my new answer, is to go look at this case study, because Dan did a bang-up job of running through all the topics.
Cool. So what else is going on?
Last thing, quick hit tail update, just wrapping up the first integration that's going live since I acquired it. And we're integrating with Basecamp. It's a pretty simple integration. We have a to-do list in Hittail, and we're just integrating with the Basecamp to-dos. And it was going to go live late last week, but you do some weird thing and you have 500 to-dos and certain page locks up, Ajax, you know, issue. So we have a little bit more troubleshooting to do, but that should go live this week. And I'm interested to see what impact that has. Because as I said last week, it's not that a bunch of Hittail people use Basecamp that we know about. It's that we want to basically be able to kind of market to the Basecamp audience and to be promoted through Basecamp's Twitter feed. And they don't have a product blog anymore, but to be on their Basecamp integrations page and to see what kind of impact that has. So luckily, it hasn't been a ton of effort on our part. So we don't need a huge amount of signups in order to justify it, but I'll definitely be updating that in the coming weeks. And we have 2 or 3 other integrations already sketched out if this one goes well.
So are you going to make the decision to move forward on those other integrations based on how this goes, or are you just going to kind of do one or two of those extra integrations kind of regardless?
Yeah, we're going to do at least two of those others because those other two are much more in our kind of in the wheelhouse of customers who would use Hittail. So they're marketing platforms like HubSpot. You know, they have an app area and it's people who are already trying to create content and market their apps and such. And so Hittail's a natural fit for that. Basecamp, the reason we did it first is number one, because it's the quickest. It was just not a lot of work on our end. And it's the first integration we're doing. So we really wanted to kind of cut our teeth and learn how to launch it and learn how to kind of get everything going. Because we have to get OAuth going and there's no ASP, classic ASP libraries for that.
Really? So, I imagine that.
So we had some workarounds there, but so we put in some work to get that done, and we're hoping that we can, you know, reap the investment with the next couple integrations, and that even if this one doesn't work out, it'll more likely be an issue of target market, and you know, we figure the next couple will be solid.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good idea to at least, as you said, cut your teeth on a couple of them just to figure out where the problem areas of your application for doing those integrations are going to be as well. So today we're going to be talking about how to pick a platform partner. And essentially, this is going to be a guide for how to evaluate whether or not a technology or a solution provider is going to be a good partner for you long term. And the problem is that sometimes it can be really difficult to evaluate the solutions of a specific vendor or a specific platforms. So a lot of these are guidelines. They're not really hard and fast rules. And generally, what you're looking for is for red flags. And the absence of red flags is something of a green light, but obviously you can't just take a blanket statement and say, well, I didn't see any red flags based on, you know, what we talk about in this podcast episode, so everything's going to be fine. You know, there's always going to be the potential for downstream, something to happen where things are just not going to work out. And sometimes your hand is just going to be forced to go in a particular direction due to price constraints or a specific technology that you're using or timeline. But basically, you just want to make sure that you are aware of what you're getting into. So some of the things that we're going to be talking about today are there's three different types of platforms that we're really talking about. And the first one is a true platform. So Amazon Web Services, Microsoft's Azure, Windows, Linux, Google's App Engine, iOS, OS X, those types of things. The second one is technology stacks and frameworks. And this really falls under things like databases, programming languages, the Mono framework, for example, jQuery, MVC, Ruby on Rails, etc. And then the third category is a company or a product API. So things like Twilio, Twitter, Facebook, Google, PayPal, Stripe, or any other payment processor, Basecamp, etc. Companies that have an API that they've made available for their products that you can leverage to either do an integration point or to truly build upon the product that they already have.
We're just going to group all of those things you've mentioned into one big bucket, right? And we're calling anyone who provides any of those things platform partners.
Yes. So the first thing to keep in mind when we're going through these is that there's a difference between something that where you're building an integration point between your product and their product versus someone who's truly a platform provider where you are completely dependent upon them providing the service. And this is a difference between, like you said earlier in this episode, you doing an integration with Basecamp where you're not completely reliant upon Basecamp with the exception of for that particular integration versus something like Justin Vincent's Plugio application, where he's completely reliant upon the Twitter API being available for him to leverage in order to make his product function.
Right, or even if you think about Hittail, it's reliant on Google and other search engines passing certain information in their search query string. So it's not it's an API of sorts. It's not necessarily a sanctioned one, but if they all change that or they suddenly stop providing that information, Hittail really is based on their platforms functioning that way.
That's right. So we have five guidelines that we're going to go through. And the first one is that the vendor or the technology plays well with others. The first part of it is especially true when you're talking about service providers. Basically, you're looking for somebody who isn't going to steal the ideas of the people who are building on their platform or steal their revenue streams. And I've seen companies out there where you'll build a product on their platform or you'll build a complementary product for their platform. And then they'll look at it and they'll say, hey, that's a great idea. And then they go ahead and they either try to work with you to work out some sort of a partnership or arrangement where there's revenue sharing. But if that doesn't work out for whatever reason, they'll just say, well, you know what, we're just going to implement that ourselves and we'll take all the revenue. And because they're the ones selling that platform to begin with, they basically have first crack at the customers for that revenue. So they can essentially push you completely out of the market. And I've seen companies do this. So what you're looking for is people who are not going to do that. And Microsoft in the 90s, I think, was a company that was really feared for this type of thing. People did not want to go head-to-head against Microsoft or anything. And Yahoo is kind of the prime example as a company that said, no, we are not a technology company, because being a technology company meant that they were going against Microsoft. They wanted to be known as a media company. And that worked great for a long time, and it really kept them out of the sights of Microsoft. But there's a lot of other companies that you have to be careful around when you're making these types of decisions. And Microsoft today is a lot more partner-focused than they were back in the 90s. But today, I think in my opinion, if you look at a company like Apple, you have to be a little bit careful about them, primarily because of the extreme secrecy around what Apple does. And I think just recently, even with iOS 6, Apple came in and said, well, Google's been providing the maps for us for the longest time, and we're going to axe that. We're going to create our own Maps app. You want to be careful about vendors who are going to come swoop in and essentially try and replace you.
Is this also like Twitter, when they bought a couple Twitter clients and then they're basically capping API usage, so several of the other Twitter clients that are still out there can't really grow that much?
Yeah, that'd be one of those in my mind. I mean, because obviously they want to make money in some way, shape, or form off of these the Twitter client that they bought. But in another way, they're basically reducing the level of competition by limiting what those other Twitter clients can do on their platform.
Right. And it seems like in the 90s, Microsoft was known as a predator. And so you treaded lightly, and you expected that they might come after you if you entered a space that they would feasibly enter. With Twitter, it wasn't really, I don't think it was really telegraphed before maybe 6 or 8 months ago that they were going to do the changes they recently made to their APIs. But I think until a company has a business model, until they have revenue, until you know how they're going to make money, they could pivot at any time and basically knock any of their partners out of the water. And that's essentially what's happening with Twitter, is they're now going after this advertising revenue model, and they're realizing that they want paid tweets and some other things where they need to control the client experience. So that decision to go after that forced their hand, and it kind of made them push out their partners who are using the API.
Right, but there's definitely ways to go about that without killing your existing partners. So, for example, they could have said, well, we're just not going to accept any new partners. Nobody else can build on it. If you're an existing partner, you already have an API, you have an API key that you can reach into our data set, that's fine. You can continue doing it.
That's basically what they've done.
No, they haven't. Actually, they put limits, though, on how many API calls those companies can do.
They already had limits before. They just changed the way they were calculated. And then they said you can have no more than, like, what is it, 100,000 unique Twitter handles if you have like a client now, or you can have twice as many as you have now. So you're right. There is a hard limit now, and there wasn't before.
Right. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, is they've basically taken a very adversarial approach to what previously were their partners and the people who helped them grow to the point that they are at now. And now those people are probably struggling at this point to try and figure out, okay, well, what can I do? How do I make money off of this? That, you know, I've already invested whatever amounts of money and time into this particular platform, and the provider is kind of shafting them. I mean, there's not a whole lot that they can do about it.
Obviously, now that they've done it, people are really wary of Twitter, and they're maybe like, they're not as predatory as Microsoft was in the 90s, but I think they should be viewed with caution, right? A lot of people are now not building stuff on Twitter's API because they know they can change it at any time. But before they started making the changes, I don't know if that they telegraphed it much.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think that beforehand, it would have been very difficult to make the call and say, oh, well, Twitter would have, you know, is going to eventually screw you down the road. I don't think that that's really a conclusion you could have justifiably come to. I think that by looking at the number of API changes that they made, you could say, well, they're not necessarily, they don't care as much about the partners that they have because they were breaking things quite a bit, from what I understand. But I could definitely see how somebody could look at that and say, you know, this isn't really a good business proposition for us because they keep breaking things for us and they don't necessarily care about that. And it's not so much that you could have looked at that and said, well, Twitter's going to become predatory, as just they just weren't playing well with others. which is a little bit different. And that's kind of the real focus of this particular, the first one is they play well with others. The second guideline for choosing a platform provider is that you find a company that really stays true to their core focus. And some companies are chasing multiple revenue streams, or, you know, in Twitter's case, they weren't chasing any revenue stream and it wasn't obvious. But in the case of companies where they're chasing multiple revenue streams and they're really not committed to any one of them, you have to be at least a little bit cautious. There's nothing inherently wrong with chasing multiple revenue streams, but as a buyer or a prospective partner, you should definitely be aware that without some level of commitment from them, they're going to be less likely to be bothered by issues that you could consider critical to your business. One way to help filter out the types of companies that stay true to their core focus is that the companies that you're working with, they don't try to be everything to everyone. And, you know, some types of customers are just not going to be right for them, and some types of partners are not going to be right for them. And if you ask them, they're going to be honest about it and tell you that up front. And instead of trying to adapt themselves to meet your needs and do absolutely everything that you need or that you're looking for, they're going to be able to just be honest with you and say, look, that's not something that we can do right now. And they may couch it a little bit and say, you know, we may look at that in the future, but those are the types of answers that you're going to get from most people who are going to be honest about it. And if somebody comes back and says, oh yeah, we have that slated for next quarter, and then next quarter comes along and it doesn't come out, and then it gets pushed a quarter and gets pushed another quarter, those are the types of things that tend to bring up flags when you're evaluating these vendors.
So the danger here is that if a company isn't staying true to their core focus, that they could easily move into your area? Is that the issue?
Well, that's part of it. The other risk, I think, is that they go in a completely different direction and they just stop supporting whatever it is that you were doing. So as an example, you can take a look at Fog Creek, where they started building CityDesk. And, you know, they were selling CityDesk back in 2000, 2001 timeframe. And then they started selling FogBugs. And they came out with version 2.0 of CityDesk. And then they essentially dropped it. They never did anything else with it ever again. And if you go to their website or you search around for it a little bit, you can still find it today. And it looks like they still have an order form for it, but that product hasn't been updated in probably close to 10 years at this point. So because Fog Creek as a company was going after a couple of different revenue streams, and then one of them took off, the risk that I was talking about was essentially they have two or three different products, or a company has a couple of different services, and one of them takes off, chances are they're going to double down on that one. And if it happens to be the one other than the one you've chosen, then you're essentially out of luck. There's not much you can do about it because they've just abandoned the one that you were relying on, and it won't make any more forward progress.
And this is a similar danger to building something in, if you built something in Visual Fox Pro years ago or VB6, and then Microsoft updates it, you know, to .NET, and kind of leaves your old coding paradigm in the past and all your framework. They don't really update the language anymore.
I think Microsoft is probably notorious on this front, just because they come out with new types of technologies, and, you know, especially when it comes to new ways to access data or new frameworks, it can be really challenging to try and pick the winner, I'll say, because they may decide, oh, well, we've got millions of users and, you know, only 200,000 of them are using this, so we're going to drop that.
Yeah, I think there's an advantage to adopting technologies. It's funny, it's that balancing act of if you adopt them too early, then you have the potential of jumping on something that never takes off. But if you adopt them too late, then, you know, these technologies only have a certain lifetime, right? I mean, if you look back to where web pages were originally built, dynamic web pages in the late 90s, it was C++, CGI scripts. Then it was there was Perl. Then there was this couple years of, it was like Cold Fusion, classic ASP 1.0, and PHP came up around then. And then really PHP is now on 5.0, which is totally different. If you still had old PHP 1.0, it probably wouldn't even run anymore. So you would have had to move that up. There were desktop apps in VB6. Those got cut off at the knees when .NET came out in 2002. And so if you're too early in the curve, something you can honestly really pick one bad, right? And it'll take a nosedive and you really get a lot of support for it. But if you wait too late, the thing could basically not be used by many people anymore. And it's not bad to have a technology. I mean, here, I own Hittail. It's in classic ASP, which hasn't been updated since, as far as I know, 2001 or 2002. So it's a 10 or 11-year-old web technology, which is just a crazy statement to say. But it's not the end of the world that we're dealing with that. I mean, everything still works. The app still works. It's just that there's no community around it. And if we run into a hard problem and the solution is not online, we're really at the mercy of spending hours and hours troubleshooting it, as well as the fact that there's no ecosystem there anymore to develop things like OAuth or integrations with, you know, REST APIs weren't around when Classic ASP was built. And so that's a trade-off you have, is that an old app will still continue to work, but when you want to update it, you want to do cool new stuff with it, you probably will have to use a newer language to then tie back into it.
Well, the other interesting thing is that because ASP is obviously on the downswing at this point, is that looking forward, I mean, how many more versions of Windows servers are still even going to support ASP?
Yeah, and I think Windows 2008 server didn't have it in by default.
It's not.
Yeah, I think it was the first year where you actually had to go in and install it yourself.
Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at Windows Server 2012 to see what's in there, but you know, that's something you may have to deal with at some point in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The third thing to look at when you're trying to choose a technology provider is that especially if it's a service provider, that they take steps to be safe with and secure with your data. And this, as I said, it applies a lot more to the platform service providers rather than to integration partners or to just technology providers. But you have to make sure that if, for example, there's a data breach, they're going to notify you and they're going to let you know that there's something wrong. And if they don't notify you, then there's something fundamentally wrong with that company and you really need to be careful about using them in the future. And I think that you can look kind of all over the internet for different companies who've run into these situations where they have a data breach and either it shows up on some web page somewhere and they just don't tell anybody about it, or they just kind of do that several weeks after the fact. And I think we ran into that at one point with our mailing list provider. People started complaining that their emails were getting spammed. And, you know, come to find out, it took probably 3 or 4 weeks, but we found out that our email provider had a data breach. And that was exactly what they did. They didn't bother to tell anybody. They just put up a web page several weeks afterwards because people had been complaining so loudly. And there was never an apology. There was never a notification of what was going on. It was just, oh, yeah, this happened. And that was it. And I think you and I just kind of said, no, that's it. We're done at this point. And we moved everything off of them and went it over to MailChimp.
Which was a painful transition. That was AWeber, which is surprisingly enough, because AWeber has been around for a long time. I would expect that they would have behaved better than that, but it was pretty shocking. And that was, 2 or 3 years ago that happened. And it's obviously, it's painful to move your mailing list because you're so entrenched into that API. You have the interface down. You have the form embedded. I mean, it's not a trivial move, but that was enough for you and I to decide to move everything over to MailChimp.
Right. And that's just a level of trust. I mean, if you can't trust them to do the right thing, then you definitely need to start looking elsewhere.
Right. And it's not that they got breached. It's that they didn't tell us they got breached. And we had to wait for complaints to come in from our prospects and customers saying they were getting spammed, essentially, by using specific emails they had set up for our stuff. And I'm just glad all that's over.
Also, part of being safe and secure with your data is that if they lose your data, and by lose, I mean, the data gets corrupted and they're not willing to do whatever they can to try and help, and they're not staying in communication with you to let you know what's going on, that's a really bad sign. And again, this just goes back to the red flags and looking for signs of things that could go wrong in the relationship down the road. And some of these things, obviously, you can't know them in advance, but you can search around and find history on companies that have been in business for a while and see what the reaction from their users has been over time. A lot of these companies have, there's websites out there where you can go and find reviews and what other people's experiences are with them. Don't necessarily trust all the marketing stuff that's on their website. Go out and find legitimate third-party reviews. Not to say that the reviews on their website aren't accurate, but they're obviously not going to publish things that cast them in any sort of a negative light as well. I mean, that's just not something you do on your own marketing material. But if there are user-submitted areas, if they have forums, definitely look through those forums and see if you can find out how they would respond to those types of things.
Twitter is probably another good place to go to see who they've been responding to and look at those conversations.
I think the only downside with Twitter is that you only get so much history there. I mean, you're only going to be able to look back so far. really what this comes down to is just, are these companies willing to own up to their mistakes? And everyone makes mistakes, and it's not a big deal that people make mistakes. It's really how they respond to those mistakes. And, you know, just keep in mind, not every customer is a good fit for every single vendor. The fourth guideline we have is that they're not stuck in the previous decade. Many people make judgments about a company based on their website, and to some extent, this is good, because if you look at a website and it looks like it hasn't been updated since the 90s, chances are it probably hasn't. And if the technology is visually stuck in the last decade, you have to wonder what's going on under the hood and how long some of that code has been there. And not that code goes bad, but problems change over time. And if the company has been changing everything under the covers over time, then chances are that that front end UI should have as well. And if the front end UI isn't changing, it may be an indication that things underneath the covers are not changing to meet the needs of new customers.
Right. And I think it depends on the business they're in, right? If you're looking at someone that's providing you with, like an app like Twitter or like some cutting edge social media type thing, you expect to have a fairly modern UI and you expect to have modern REST APIs, not things that are whatever, like web services from 2001. Whereas if you're dealing with someone and maybe you're getting government data for something, for housing prices or for some old metric that, you know, maybe the company's been around for 20 years, you're going to give them a little more leniency. And they can have a website that looks older, an API that maybe was built in the late 90s, and you're going to give them a little more leeway because, hey, they haven't updated it and they may not have had a reason to do so. So, I mean, I think an interesting look is if you look at MailChimp versus AWeber, who we were just talking about. The AWeber API is old. They haven't really updated their UI in years. And I think they retain a lot of the customers that they've always had. But I think if someone comes to the MailChimp website and looks around, there's a very different feeling. There is a lot more of a high-tech startup, like these guys are constantly updating their app, versus AWeber, which is more like it's a very consistent, it's a more classic aged app. I mean, that's only a bad thing if you want new features to be rolled out constantly. I think there's pluses and minuses on both sides. But I have heard complaints from people who are still using AWeber that they wish there were some new like split testing and, you know, features that MailChimp has rolled out that they wish AWeber would get on as well.
And the fifth guideline for choosing a platform provider is that they are able and willing to help you. If they're honest and willing to tell you when they're not going to be a good fit for you, or if they have documentation and resources that are available that they can point you to and they will help you in the right direction, then they're probably going to be a good fit for you. But if they're willing to yes you to death and do anything it takes to land you as a customer, and then you find out after the fact that they just really weren't a good fit or that you weren't a good fit for their services, that's obviously a bad sign. And you're going to have to dig a little bit. Your chances are good. You're going to have to get on their support. You're going to have to ask them some questions. Ask them straightforward and say, you know, will this work in your environment? And if so, how is it intended to work? If you have any questions about how it's supposed to work or how your product is going to integrate into their platform and they're not able to give you satisfactory answers and they don't necessarily seem knowledgeable about it, either ask for somebody who's a little bit higher up or, you know, take what they're saying with a grain of salt. Do some additional testing. And this might even be a good opportunity to outsource some of that work to Odesk and see if somebody can build a very, very quick prototype using the technology and the ways that they've outlined to see if it actually works or not.
In terms of them being able and willing to help you, how does that play into something like open source software or into like the Google App Engine, where there isn't really support?
Well, I think that those types of things, when you're looking at open source anything, I mean, is there a community behind it? Because if that community is there, then chances are good that they're willing to help you. But there are, and I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I can imagine that there's probably an open source community out there where they're very closed and very not helpful, I'll say. And you try building something with whatever the software is, and they're just like, oh, you're doing it wrong. You have no idea what you're doing. Just go away. I can't imagine that there's very many of them because I wouldn't think that they would last very long or get very big. But I could imagine that there might be a couple out there that are kind of on the bleeding edge, and they're just like, we don't have time for you. Just leave us alone. Figure it out yourself.
Or if it's a community that's really small or virtually non-existent, I could see that's like kind of like not having support available.
Yeah, there's a difference between having dead air and somebody just being not helpful. I could see dead air being much more prevalent than something like, you know, just people just saying no, go away. really what you're looking for is, are they willing to try and make whatever it is that you're trying to do work? You know, are they offering solutions? Are they offering places you can go for help? And not to say that they'll do it for you, but they're trying to make your life easier as opposed to making you jump through hoops.
Is there any way to tell before you integrate with them whether they're going to be able and willing to help you? Because like you said, they might yes you to death before the sale. And then once you get into it, you know, you build the thing and then they're not very helpful. How do you avoid that?
Well, I think that building prototypes is a good way to do it. And for a prototype, you don't necessarily have to build everything that you're looking to do. Just try building one piece of it. And if it's something like doing an OAuth integration, that's just one piece of the entire thing, and you think that that's going to be a problem area, work on that one piece. Or go to Odesk and outsource it to somebody and say, hey, I need you to make this work. And take a look at the output and see if it, you know, is remotely readable. If the person had to jump through hoops in order to get it to work. And, you know, if you put them in touch with the vendor and they're not able to help or unwilling to help, then, you know, that says something about what level of support you can expect in the future. I think the big key is making sure that you don't spend a lot of money before you kind of get into it. And I've heard horror stories from people about spending $15,000, $20,000, $50,000 before they even get something installed, and then having to do all these customizations and then come to find out, oh, by the way, this isn't going to work because of such and such bug that's a known issue. So I think that wraps up how to pick a platform partner. And as I said before, the things to keep in mind are, when you're evaluating a vendor, make sure that they play well with others. Make sure that the company is staying true to their core focus. Make sure that they're taking steps to be safe and secure with the data that you're putting into them or onto their services. And make sure that they're not stuck in the last decade. And the fifth one is to make sure that they're able and willing to help you. If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.